Hi, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this week, our good movie is the 1968 Japanese film, Blackmail Is My Life. And our bad movie is the 1992 horror movie Dr. Giggles, starring Larry Drake, who was in our last week's episode about the Darkman series, where he was no doubt spotted as a villainous presence and given the role in a cheesy horror movie. But as is usually the case, we're going to talk about the good movie first, and that's Blackmail Is My Life, also known as Blackmail Is My Business, and Call Me Blackmail, and a lot of other kind of funny alternate titles. But I'd seen this before for the first time a few years ago, and this is only my second time, and I still found the movie really fun. And it's about a guy who's a blackmailer, as you might expect, and he's got a gang of three other kind of hoodlums that he knows, and they're pretty small time, but kind of the plot of the movie is that they get more and more involved with blackmailing people who are more powerful and have more money, but with that comes the danger, and yeah, pretty soon they're total failures as blackmailers. But it's really about this guy who kind of narrates the film, and we see in the first 20 minutes or so that he used to just be a working stiff, and then he realized that blackmail is really profitable and that everyone has a secret. And it's a really funny movie. I mean, I love how it just kind of like grabs you right away and throws you into his world. And him and his partners in crime are real glib and wisecracking. And it's got this jazzy soundtrack, kind of like swing jazz. And and the directing, the way it's directed is really, well, it's kind of its time. It's like French New Wave or pop art or something. There's lots of zooms. There's this technique that you keep seeing where like still frames from the movie freeze, and then we hear the main character narrating over them and hearing his kind of sardonic humor. And it's got a real sardonic kind of black sense of humor, and it sort of reminds me of, like, I don't know, there's actually like a lot of movies like this now. I don't know exactly when there got to be more of them, maybe in the 90s, but like it's kind of a common thing now for a movie to be about, you know, a group of criminals who are all, you know, wisecracking and jovial with each other. And with a movie like Blackmail Is My Life, it really kind of works because they're only blackmailing people who have stuff to hide, like cheap restaurant owners who are using watered-down booze, stuff like that. It's one of his first blackmails. You know, like Jean-Luc Godard kind of made movies with criminal characters. I mean, Breathless is a famous example. But, you know, in Asian films, too, like in Japanese films in the 60s, there were these, like, crime movies that had this really kind of flashy, stylized pop sensibility. And I kind of found out about those because they were released on the Criterion label. Movies like Tokyo Drifter from 66 and Branded to Kill from 67. And those were both by the same director. But, you know, you see the posters for these movies, and it's like, you know, you're looking at Andy Warhol or something. Like, these kind of movies are really fun. And they kind of, it's funny, but I feel like they kind of synthesize, like, the coolest sensibilities from the 50s and 60s. Like, from the 50s, they have this kind of, like, glib Technicolor swagger, and like the swinging jazz music makes it like, I don't know, a Rat Pack caper movie like the original Ocean's 11 or something. And then like from the 60s, they have all this like wild camera movement that guys like Jean-Luc Godard popularized. Like, there are so many zooms in this movie. Like, the camera is just, like, constantly flying in and out of people's faces and using lots of still frames and using narration, and it's really, it's just, like, really fun to watch stylistically. And I guess if I had one kind of, my other point about the kind of movie this was is that, like, I think, like, in America, like, by 68, movies like this were starting to, it's sort of like, there were probably more American crime movies in the 70s, but they sort of chose to take a grittier, down-to-earth look at things. But, I mean, Blackmail Is My Life is like if the Beatles were in a blackmail movie. Like, if a Hard Day's Night were about blackmail, it would be just as kind of carefree. And I think that's basically because, you know, Japan being a homogenous culture wasn't going through the kind of social unrest that was taking the glib and frothy sheen off of American pop culture by 1968. But in Japan, like, the main character says it at the beginning, like, what a great time to be alive, you know? The country is going through huge capitalist business boom, and there's lots of money flowing around. And the funny thing about how that relates to blackmail is that, I mean, I'm not a professional criminal, but it seems to me like blackmail is, like, the best time to be a blackmailer is when there's a lot of prosperity around, because then it's like, I mean, if you're being blackmailed, I think it's like you have a choice between being publicly embarrassed and losing things or just, you know, paying a guy off. And when the money's flowing, that's when it's the main character also says this in the opening narration. He says, like, you know, things are so good right now that the people who we blackmail aren't even, like, you know, taking a big hit. And an early scene in the movie is, like, he's talking to his friends, like, one of whom is an ex-boxer, one of whom is an ex-Yakuza, and one of whom is a cute girl. And in a very kind of Godard-esque touch, he, like, introduces them over still frames of them. And for the cute girl, he says, like, she doesn't do much of anything, but she's, you know, a cute girl, and you gotta have one of those hanging around. But yeah, he there's a scene where he's talking to his gang, and they're going over the rules of blackmail, and they have three rules of blackmail, which are, don't push too hard, don't hit the same mark twice, and I forget what the third one is, but it's kind of like about halfway through the movie, things really start to fall apart for this guy because they violate their own rule of, like, actually, it's not so much that they violate their own rules, it's that, like, they should have had one more rule, which is, like, you know, don't try to fry a fish, don't go after the big fish, you know. Because what you're doing is small. If you're a small-time blackmailer, don't go after the big fish because, like, yeah, they've got money, but it's going to be just as easy for them to kill you as it is to drop a few dollars. And also they try blackmailing some very powerful people for even larger amounts of money, and that proves to be really stupid. But so, yeah, I mean, it's a really, the first half of the movie is, like, incredibly fun because it's just like a party, a blackmail party or something, and then they start screwing up, and the movie's still good after that, but, I mean, I sort of like this movie a lot just for that first half alone, and how fun it is, and how, like, you know, it's one of those movies that makes you feel, I don't remember who said this. I hope it's not Roger Ebert, but it might have been. And there's some film critic who said that, you know, the reason that with a lot of movies, like, you can kind of enjoy watching the activity of criminals, and you can watch, like, a movie star playing a, you know, basically a bad person, but still get really involved in them and like them even, is because, like, people will like any movie character. No matter how despicable, as long as they're good at their job. And that's definitely true for the gang of blackmailers, at least up till the point where they start taking some ill-advised risks in their blackmailing outfit. But what did you think of it?
I mean, I loved it. It kind of reminded me of Blowout in some ways, just in how...
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Blowout is... You sort of get the idea of their... Blow out. You get the idea of there being fun without actually everybody else is having fun, and he should be, but he's instead doing his thing. But in Blackmail Is My Life, you get to see them having the fun, too. So, and it's also just his narration's so good, and mm-hmm. sort of narrated movie like this, every time there is a really good one, I almost forget them. Or not forget them, but it seems like popular narrated movies are Tarantino movies, right? Don't some of his... Actually, Romance. True Romance is narrated to some degree. But, I mean, this is like the affable... I mean, he's really likable, and the way they present being a blackmailer in Japan is that it's just a job. Like, mm-hmm. if you don't have something to hide, you shouldn't have gotten, you know, caught. You shouldn't have gotten... Mm-hmm. It's your fault that they're blackmailing you.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there are just some really hilarious scenes, like when the one guy... So what they really do for a bit of it is the way they get their information is they sort of take over other people's blackmail rings.
They actually... Like, the first kind of complicated sequence where you see them blackmailing someone is where they set up a blackmailer to blackmail someone who's one of them, and then they blackmail a blackmailer with his blackmailing business.
And a hilarious, you know, we're going to kill him, how are we going to kill him thing going on.
Oh, yeah, they make him think they're going to kill him, and then he's just, you know, a blubbering mess. Right.
So, I mean, it's really funny, and then...
It takes a pretty sharp turn at some point.
It takes a sharp turn, but, I mean, the ending's hilarious. I was sitting there watching it going...
Yeah, well, the ending does kind of bring it full circle, because the ending is just as... spoiler alert here, we're going to discuss the ending.
Yeah.
When he gets stabbed in the street at the end, you know, by the criminal who isn't able to be blackmailed anymore, but he doesn't know that. But he's bleeding it out in the street, and at first it's kind of bizarre because people are like looking at him, and I guess they knew it was a movie or something. Like, they seem like real people who are just ignoring him.
Yeah.
But then suddenly there's a crowd there, and he's staggering, and he's flashing back to happier times and also sadder times and stuff. And he does that a lot in the movie, and one of his girlfriends even comments on it. Like, you're always obsessing about the past, but then he just goes like, oh shit, this sucks, and then the movie just kind of ends like right there, like really abruptly, and it's just as kind of just, it kind of reminds you that, you know, it was all just a movie, and this is just kind of it's funny how abrupt the ending is.
And I could not think of an American movie, I know there have been some, but certainly nothing of this period that ever did anything like that. That had the criminal, the self-aware criminal getting, I guess, some sort of comeuppance at the end and it being played as a joke. I mean, they just...
Yeah.
It's just not in the American sort of...
Yeah, I mean, you know, this movie reminded me... I mean, because, like, there weren't... I guess the thing about American crime movies at the time is that, like, there really weren't... I mean, unless it was something pretty mainstream, like Ocean's 11. There weren't a lot of movies about, like, glib, charismatic criminals until, like, I guess Bonnie and Clyde in 67. But then New Hollywood didn't want to make crime movies because that was, like, too bourgeoisie and too establishment to just make movies about guys who want money, you know? But, like, there were some movies like John Borman's Point Blank starring Lee Marvin, which have all this really kind of expressive camera work and direction, but Point Blank is a fairly, even though it's got some really funny black humored parts in it, and it is based on a crime novel by, I don't think it was Elmore Leonard, but someone like that. It's like, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of gravity when Lee Marvin gets it at the end because he's Lee Marvin.
Yeah,
this movie, like, you know, it's not a star vehicle or anything. You know, they don't have to give a dignified ending to this guy.
But I don't even think that in independent American movies they're doing anything approaching.
No, that's also true. I mean, I guess, you know, yeah, because movies like, I don't know, Don Siegel's the Killers movie is like a pretty kind of, it was made in the late 60s or mid 60s, I guess, and it's a really kind of ultra modern for its time crime movie that does break some rules and stuff, but it doesn't do anything. It doesn't really like pull the rug out from under you in any way.
Yeah, I mean, it takes itself seriously to a point,
right.
And in a way, by taking the criminal seriously and not ever letting the viewer in, I mean, this sort of puts you in the mind of the criminal more than pretty much anything.
I guess because like the main character in Blackmail Is My Life, he's kind of like, you know, living his. He's got a glib attitude towards everything, and he's living his life one day at a time, and that's why he can be a criminal, but he's also always thinking about the past, and, you know, we see him thinking about the past right at the start of the movie, so we're kind of there with him. Someone who's, like, you know, living on the edge every day, but kind of lives in the past, too. And that's how he's relatable, because otherwise, you know, he wouldn't be as likable if we didn't see him, like, you know, mopping floors and that kind
right.
of stuff. But by seeing him mopping floors and getting kicked out by his girlfriend for being a leech, then we can sort of be there with him with, like, you know, yeah, this is, but now this is the life. And all those ordinary people out there are just suckers, you know? They're all just marks.
The ordinary people being suckers and marks, I'm trying to remember that has been reused in an American movie.
Oh, yeah. No,
somewhat recently. I mean, within the last post-Tarantino era. He might have even said that in something, right?
Something like that, yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting because it's this great movie, but in some ways I don't think that it's got any influence. I mean, I know Criterion's got it out, right?
Okay. No, actually, it wasn't Criterion who put this out on DVD.
Okay.
It was some other company.
Because I don't feel that it's that it has the crossover influentialness of lot of other
stuff.
Well,
it wasn't, you know, I think the Japanese pop crime movies that Criterion has put out, they came before this, so they kind of, the director of those kind of gets more of the credit. But so this was sort of, I guess, in the mold of something that was already a bit established stylistically, but as an example of that, it's just got so much stuff that you know, when people try to make freewheeling fun crime movies now, they aspire to it. But I guess it's a hard kind of story to pin down as far as like having you collude with the criminals in terms of like enjoying the fun of getting away with stuff, but then also kind of wanting to see them get out of the bad situations that they've put themselves into. And the fact that it doesn't really work out at the end kind of gives it a certain reality, or gives a certain gravity to everything that you've seen happen, because he gets killed at the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, when we're saying that these are sort of fun-loving criminals, it's not like Ocean's 11, the remake.
Right, but I'm thinking of even stuff like, I don't know, Swordfish was about some robbers, right? Some heisters.
Yeah, but it had the whole international terrorism thing added to it, so I mean, I think that...
I guess movies like this, like, you know, if you have a group of criminals, sometimes what'll happen is they'll run into... Well, I mean, this happens in Blackmail Is My Life also. They kind of they cross paths with criminals who are, like, really bad people, or worse than them. And, yeah, usually that means at that point in the story that they're now going to have to, you know, do some good. But that's not the case in Blackmail Is My Life. It's just, you know, they think they can bilk people who are more ruthless than they are, and they're wrong.
In it.
And I feel like I think the first time I watched this, like, I kept wondering if they were going to catch on to that a little bit, but they never do. Like, because the leader of the gang, the chief blackmailer, he has like way too much confidence in himself.
Yeah, and when things start to change is when one of the team's brother or his father dies.
The muscle of the gang.
The muscle's father dies.
Yeah.
And so they then have to, they deal with that, but they, even before they deal with it by starting to break their rules, there's this really interesting thing that I don't think I've ever seen before. It's what happens when the leader of a gang is incommunicado and the rest of the gang needs him to make decisions for them. Which happened in this with, he's off with his girlfriend.
Right.
And he won't answer the phone, and they sort of, you know, basically don't do anything for a day while they are, you know, waiting to get a hold of him, and then they bring him in, and then it's still by committee then, but it's like they could not function without him there. So it's a very interesting, well, this whole romance is a really awkward sort of a side of the movie where he's dating one of his blackmailing victims.
Right. And there's no, and it's kind of a joke, like, because they jump cut from him showing, incriminating, she's like a soap opera actress, and he shows her an incriminating photo of her with some guy, and then they cut to them together some period of time later. So it's like after she paid him off, they kind of fell for each other, and she says later, like, yeah, I like bad boys. But yeah, that's kind of pointless now that I think about it. But I don't know, I guess he needed some romantic attachment to keep him distracted from the gang at that point.
Right, because, and then at a certain point, another interesting thing, when he and the girl get together, the girl that's in the gang, they eventually get together in this sort of, oh, we should have always been together, romance type thing.
But it feels a little more like desperation, because, like, he pretty much knows. It's like when he's just had this phone call with the guy who he's trying to blackmail, and the guy who he's trying to blackmail isn't very impressed.
Yeah.
So he needs to kind of, you know, bolster his confidence at that moment.
Followed by, it's like a blackmailer is kind of like a newspaper reporter, but not, I guess, is one way of looking at it.
That's interesting. I mean, that might have been an intentional subtext because of the newspaper reporter characters that are in it and who want this incriminating memo that the guy is trying to blackmail a crime boss with and ends up getting killed over.
And
it's kind of implied at the end that that the girl of the gang is going to go off with the newspaper reporter now that the
well, we never see any reaction to that. You're being mean. She could pine over him for a little bit.
Or she'll go back to school, like she says.
Or she'll go back to school. Yeah, that's kind of the funny thing is that he's a sort of shiftless, you know, just regular working guy. Mm-hmm. There's the muscle of the gang who, it appears, knows how to box. So maybe he was a boxer. There's the Yakuza guy. But yeah, the girl apparently was just a college student or something like that. I mean, she doesn't look young enough not to be.
Yeah, well, in the little scene where we're hearing their voiceovers about how, you know, ordinary people are suckers, she says, like, all right, preying off people's weaknesses. This is going to be fun. And then at the end of at the movie where it's like, well, I guess the show's over, she's like, well, it was fun. But
yeah.
It's over now, I guess.
And the Yakuza guy does retire. He's too put out by the death of, oh, well, there you go. The muscle dies. After they start escalating their, they start branching out into.
Yeah, they start going after, like, you know, drug lords and stuff.
And that's okay for them, but once they start going after political things, and I mean, I guess, yeah, that's a, it's a big jump, because they're going after, that conceivably it would bring down the government of the, you know, the federal government of Japan. So they might not have thought that out, but
yeah,
it's never that clear what exactly it's gonna do, because there's a really funny thing where it's like, it's really complicated, let me try and explain it to you. And it's just kind of like, then there's this montage of exteriors. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, and then of exterior shots of stuff, and then it's sort of explained, and then it's done. And it's just like, if you don't get it, it doesn't matter, really.
Yeah, it's just a MacGuffin.
Yeah, it's a lot of exposition for something that you might not actually need to know. Which is fine. So, yeah. It's just interesting that it's such a complicated thing that...
Well, I mean, the guy who wrote this was, like, based on his own novel, I think. And, you know, there's probably more detail about it there, but for the purpose of the movie, they just explain it rather quickly. And the guy actually wrote some other movies, too. I'd like to look into those, because, you know, it's not the plot of this movie, but just the characterizations that are the strongest. Like, each member of the gang is pretty distinct. Especially, well, the guy and the girl, obviously, but then the muscle, too, and... Yeah, even just the way, like, people talk to each other on the phone and stuff is really, it's really, like, just good crime fiction writing. Like,
yeah.
The lead blackmailer is talking to the guy in a payphone and saying, like, and that he doesn't know that, but that the guy he's trying to blackmail, like, knows that this memo is a forgery yet. So he's saying to the guy, like, you know, yeah, here's how much. And then the guy laughs at him, and you see the lead blackmailer getting real nervous. It's like, wait, why are you laughing? And then on the other end of the line, you hear the guy go, let me think about it. All right, sure, yeah, I'll buy it back from you.
Which does not go well for...
And then the guy, like, has just heard this guy laugh at him, but then he's like, oh, okay, you know, he's like really desperately wants to believe that it's going according to plan, and it doesn't mean anything that the guy, that his blackmail victim just laughed at him over the phone. Like, that might not mean he's being set up for something.
I mean, it's clear that our the lead is not that smart of a guy.
Right, exactly.
And so, I mean, that's sort of some of the interesting stuff of it is that, you know, he's getting by on just his perseverance way.
Yeah.
That he's you're able to be a successful blackmailer just by trying, really.
Uh-huh.
And it, you know, it gets the brain going, thinking about what it must. Yeah, it's just it's kind of a cool setup, because I mean, you know, thinking about heist movies, I think that some of it is always that you are part of it's always that they never want to kill anybody, you know. And so they're not as bad. It's a victimless crime in some way. And in this one, it's kind of like, well, no, it's a victim-full crime, but it's still sort of just really amusing. Because they actually don't, like, blackmail. The most innocent person they blackmail has got to be the girlfriend, right?
Right.
So, and it's only him blackmailing her. Otherwise, it's... They're going after basically criminals or other blackmailers and that sort of thing. So that's,
yeah. The other thing, too, is that, like, big heist movies, like, it's always about some big heist. And, yeah, they try to, you know, especially if, like, John Travolta is the leader of the gang or something, they don't want to have to show John Travolta shooting a housewife in the head in cold blood because she saw something. So they try to keep it victimless crimes, but, you know, kind of the stakes are so big for their big heist that it's really hard to believe. It just seems completely fake. Kind of the reality of something like Blackmail Is My Life is from the fact that, at least at the beginning, they're going after relatively small targets. So you can believe that, like, you know, with some regularity of going after, you know, just penny pinching restaurant owners and stuff, that they could make a good living off of this and not have to be smart at it, but just, you know, clever, a little more clever than the criminals that they're bilking. And I think, like, you know, the characterizations are so strong actually that the movie, as good as it is, I would have liked it even more if the second half weren't about how it starts to unravel, if it were more about, like, you know, the four of them doing this and then maybe splitting up by their own devices or something, but just kind of maintaining the idea of it that, you know, if you aim low, you can just sort of make it a regular part-time job or something.
Him low. Yeah. And does he even have an apartment? Or a place where he lives that we actually see?
Is that apartment his or his girlfriend's that has the big photo
Of
of
her,
his?
that's hers.
Okay, yeah, and it's very 60s. She's got like a huge blown up photo of herself on one of her walls, but yeah, that is her place.
So we
So,
never actually see where he resides, which is interesting.
yeah, never thought about that, or any of them actually. Sort of irrelevant.
Yeah.
You kind of don't want to believe that these people have homes that they come home to at the end of the day.
Mundane little, yeah.
That's too mundane, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And we're not even touching on some of the other really funny stuff in it. And the nice thing is that even once it starts getting serious, they keep the same sort of sensibilities about it because he hasn't realized and doesn't until the third act he's in over his head.
Yeah.
So it's still somewhat playful. I mean, like when they firebomb, when they Molotov cocktail the
Yeah.
it, you know, that scene is always sort of amusing until they burn the money, and even then it's still somewhat amusing,
Yeah,
but
even then they're laughing about the fact that they burned the money. He doesn't turn into Clarence Boddicker and, like, you know, throw the boxer out the back or something.
yeah.
You burned the fucking money. It's as good as Mark, you asshole. It's always back to RoboCop with me. I'm
Well, what
sorry.
can you do? I mean, that's just kind of, the way things go. Is it RoboCop is where it goes sometimes, and there's much more of a chance that. Well, I don't know. I mean, this seems like the kind of thing Tarantino would have seen, doesn't it?
Certainly, yeah.
But he hasn't, which doesn't make any sense in a way.
Well, how do we know?
I.
He might have the poster in
He
his.
very well could.
He might have to pull out the poster clause when he gets caught ripping this off at some point.
Wait, what?
When someone brought it to his attention, or rather brought it to his attention that he knew. I don't think they were trying to blackmail him, but they said, like, "Hey, there's this Chow Yun Fat movie that has the exact same plot as Reservoir
Oh,
Dogs.
right, yeah.
What's up with that?" And he was like, "Oh yeah, City on Fire. I love that movie. I got the poster up in my office." Next question. It's so the poster, the poster clause is, if you're a big enough fan of a movie to have the poster in your office, then you can steal from it.
Tarantino had an office when he made Reservoir Dogs. That kind of ruins my image of him.
No, afterwards. Well, I don't
Okay.
know. Yeah.
Now, speaking of posters, as I try and find a segue for us,
Yeah.
I believe the Dr. Giggles poster is him in a surgical mask over the
Yeah.
house, right?
Yeah. I have a story about that, actually, but what did you want to say about it? It's not really a story. It's just that when the movie came out, let's see, whenever, in 1992, I had bought a Spider-Man comic that was really lame. It was about a kid finding a gun and almost shooting the bully who picks on him until Spider-Man intervenes. But it had an ad in the back for Dr. Giggles, and it was that poster, and it had the tagline, which was, "If you live in Morhai and you get sick, lie on your knees and pray you die quick. Dr. Giggles." And that scared the hell out of me, because, like, the idea, because, like, the poster also shows him standing in front of a house with his medical bag, and he's holding a gleaming knife, and I thought, like, oh, man, it would be so scary if the doctor who made house calls in some little town, like, turned crazy and just came to your house and then killed you because you were sick. And, I mean, it doesn't make sense, like, how someone could do that more than once, but...
It's scary. Well, he could in this movie.
It was really scary. He doesn't really do anything like that in this movie except for coming to someone's house. But it's not like he comes over to someone's house because, like, he got a phone call. So that's not really in the movie. But, that definitely scared me as a kid. And suffice to say, the movie's not really scary. Although, I may as well get this out of the way. There's two things in the movie which I'll give credit to the movie for. The only two things I can say about it, because they're actually genuinely freaky. And you probably know what one of them is that I'm thinking of. The first one is he kills someone by jamming some medical instrument up their nose. And he jams it up the nose of a really good fake head that you don't realize is fake until...
Yeah.
The thing is up the nose.
That thing was really gross.
It was incredibly gross. And, you know, I'm sure it, like, belonged in a better movie, basically. But that's kind of the magic of, like, you know, prosthetic and puppet effects in 1992, just before CG took over. Because now it would be a CG head or something. But that was really good. And then there's also this bizarre and horrifying image, which... really must have, it would have messed me up as a kid, and I'm sure it messed up the kid who did it, but it's a flashback of, like, little kid, young Dr. Giggles, who was crazy back then, too, because his dad was crazy, crawling out of the belly of his mother by, like, making an incision from inside and crawling out, and then, like, being all blood-caked and brandishing a scalpel at this guy.
No.
And it is horrifying.
It is. That is a. Those are the two really freaky scenes. But I do have one problem with the second one. They would have noticed the sutures. She was sewn back together. They would have noticed.
Yeah, he was in his mom's stomach, by the way, because they came to arrest his dad, and his dad had to sneak him out of the house somehow. So he sewed up his son in his wife's belly without anyone noticing, without any incisions being made, and then somehow the kid inside the belly didn't suffocate.
Well, he had, you know, a straw.
But it's sort of, I guess that's part of why it's so horrifying, is it's like, it doesn't make any sense, so it's surreal more than anything.
Now...
It's like a total nightmare image, seeing a kid crawl out of a woman's belly and being all maniacal looking.
Did you find the Werner Herzog thing, or did I find it, or...
Oh, I think you might have mentioned it
in
the last episode, but...
Yeah. So, you know, when we started talking about seeing this, I had seen the ad for it on comic books, too. It was on a lot of them, I think. It was that. I remember that. Dr. Giggles ads on every single Vertigo comic. And Predator 2 pullout ads that were in all the DC comics back in 90. But so, I mean, those were two really big ads that I remember. And what's interesting about Dr. Giggles is it was produced by Dark Horse's...
I saw that in the open titles, and I was thinking... Wow. I was thinking, like, that couldn't possibly be the comic book company, could it?
It is, and they really didn't do very much after barbed wire, shockingly.
Yeah.
They're kind of back a little, and they've done stuff that isn't necessarily from comics, and I think they're trying to get more into that in some ways. But what's funny is that the guy who is credited, I think he's the executive, not the executive, but the co-producer, Mike Richardson. Something that's happened to Dark Horse from what I've read is that, you know, back in this era, they used to do a lot of dark slashery comics, and they don't do those anymore because the guy has kids now who are of age, and he doesn't think it's cool to do it anymore. And so it's just weird that his name is on a slasher movie when he won't let them make slasher movies anymore. Whatever. Yeah. So there was a comic book adaptation too, which I
nice.
Yeah.
This is a really, you know, this was like 3 years before Scream, and man, it was really late in the game for anyone to be making a slasher movie in 1992. But it's like, you know, I guess at this point they just figured, you know, hey, it's been the formula's been established so well. It's a minimum. It's a guaranteed return on your investment to come up with a gimmick for a killer and just make a movie about that. And now, was this released by Universal, or was Universal involved with this?
Maybe they did release it theatrically, but it's gone over to Warner for video for some reason.
Well, I was thinking that, like, you know, I guess, you know, Universal makes sense because you've got Larry Drake as Dr. Giggles, and he's, you know, he made his name as a villain in Darkman 2 years before this. But the fact that I feel like you know, Manny Coto, the guy who wrote and directed it, must have just been watching some Universal slasher movies or some Universal horror movies at the time and just been, like, trying to figure out how he could contribute a marketable character to the Universal library of horror movie stuff. Because, like, there's, like, a shot where, okay, there's two things in this movie that reminded me of Child's Play 2 and 3 is what I'm trying to say. There's, like, a shot where he, you know, someone's looking through a keyhole, and then he looks through the keyhole, and you see his big blue eye looking back. And then there's a carnival out of nowhere, and there's a chase in the carnival, and that was in Child's Play 3. But anyways, I mean, it's definitely a formula movie, but it follows the formula really it doesn't know how to follow the formula. I mean, and when you don't know how to follow the formula for a slasher movie, you're in trouble. Like, number one, one of the rules I think that Halloween established really well, the original Carpenter movie, is that, like, you know, the final girl of the movie should have some kind of connection to the killer, so that when they're facing off at the end, after the killer's killed all the final girl's friends, it's like the culmination of something. But Dr. Giggles is really weird because, like, the movie opens with Dr. Giggles escaping out of the mental institution, and then you start seeing this girl and, you know, and her friends, and it's like watching a different movie or something. And she has this boyfriend who she has scenes with, and, like, it's not like the boyfriend shows up at the end and saves her or anything.
Yes, he does, kind of. Well, he gets his ass kicked. But
yeah,
He's not
really there in the end long enough to justify the scenes with him and her, like, at high school, which really feel like a different movie. And they just cut to her, and it's like, you know, okay, this girl lives in the town where the guy is headed, but you don't know why Dr. Giggles is headed to this town yet. They you know, they let you know about that in little increments as the movie goes on. And the girl just has all these stupid teenage friends to get bumped off, you know, at certain minute markings, and it's like, the friends, the two teenagers who blocked the two, you know, surprise black teenagers in the house where Dr. Giggles is hiding, like, they get killed, and nobody wonders where they went.
No.
Even though they're, like, the only two black people in town, and, you know, someone should be worried. I didn't mean for it to insinuate that they are victims of hate crime. But it's just like, it's so, this is like exactly the kind of movie that made Scream a huge hit, because it just assumes that you, the viewer, are like, you're you're dumber than dirt, and it's just the only thing that's making this movie different from any other movie is the gimmick of the killer, which is that he's a doctor, and that's kind of, you know, like, you know, the poster and the tagline scared me because that was like, you know, I was imagining like a horror movie about a doctor that was actually very specifically tailored to what a small town doctor does, whereas even though it's Dr. Giggles and he kills people with, you know, medical instruments, it's like he still just kind of like, you know, wanders around town killing people practically like he's Michael Myers or something. You know, Brian Usna directed this movie called The Dentist in 97 with Corbin Burnson. And that's a good horror movie. And it really specifically, it's not like just a slasher movie with a gimmick villain in it. It sort of like makes the dentist the main character and then comes up with a story that plays out of how he goes crazy so that you see him being a normal dentist and then gradually he goes crazy and then he's using his dental tools for nefarious purposes. But this guy's just an evil doc, a crazy guy actually who thinks he's a doctor. And his backstory about how he had a crazy doctor father, which plays into being sewn up into his mom's stomach. That's also like a slasher movie technique that this movie doesn't know how to do right, because like if your killer was traumatized as a child, you need to establish that up front. It's really stupid to, I mean, especially when he got such a crazy scene. Like, if that coming out of the mother's stomach scene had been like the pre-credits sequence, mm-hmm. you would be on the edge of your seat for the rest of the movie. You'd be really disappointed, but you would be on the edge of your seat, and it would. They dole out these flashback scenes as it goes on. Like it's a big deal to find out how this guy's background is. Like, you already know he's a crazy guy who thinks he's a doctor, and it's just so tedious, and this movie is so long. It's an hour and a half, but it feels so incredibly long because like there's no rhyme or reason to the order of things. I mean, like, they should have just copied Halloween and have been done with it, but it's like they thought that by like taking the basic plot beats of Halloween and rearranging them in some silly order would elevate it a little bit. But yeah, in 1992, it was a really kind of a fool's errand to try to make a movie where a crazy guy kills. I mean, because this is a year after Freddy's Dead, for goodness sake, after like, you know, the number one stand-up comedian killer with postmortem one-liners was put to rest, and they're like, oh well, let's see if we can create a new franchisable one-liner spouting character. So yeah, everything about this movie feels incredibly tired. And speaking of Freddy's Dead, Brian May did the music for this.
Yeah,
too, and
I saw that.
And he did the music for the Mad Max movies, which have incredible music, and then he ended up doing stuff like this, and he really deserves a medal for doing what he can with it. Oh boy, it was bad.
Yeah, it was kind of like the most painful thing to watch since The Nut, as far as our bad movies go, because it's just so...
The Nut?
The Net.
Oh, The Net, okay.
Because when we talked about watching this, I thought it was like a movie that Holly Marie Combs made while she was on Picket Fences. I didn't realize she made it before Picket Fences, which is kind of different from going from, you know, your very elegantly scripted television show to a slasher movie. It's a little bit different when you're going from a slasher movie to that. It doesn't really connect at all. And if she hadn't been on that, nobody would know who she was now, because it's not like people cast off of Dr. Giggles. And then Glenn Quinn's in it from Roseanne. He was on Roseanne a lot. as one of the sister's daughter's boyfriends, and I realized that I didn't recognize him. And I'm like, so I know his name, but I don't actually know what he looks like. And it's actually the Manny Coto is he's the showrunner on 24. So this guy went on to success eventually. And I wonder,
not in the horror genre though.
No, and I just wonder, did people who worked for him find out about this and like when he was being crappy? Like when he was being bossy on set, like, you can't do that, you know.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. And they're just like, shut up, dude. You made Dr. Giggles. Because, I mean, like...
yeah. I mean, he conceived of this character. He tried to conceive of, like, a, you know, the next big horror movie icon. And it's not as if... talking about Larry Drake for a moment, it's not as if he's not up to the challenge of playing a crazy killer doctor. I mean, he's got a million medical related one-liners, and he delivers them about as well as, you know, as can be delivered. And it's just like he has nothing to do really except to shove things up people's noses and make the one-liners. And there's like a few scenes that kind of lead into the sporadic flashbacks where he's looking at like old photos of himself when he was a kid or whatever. And it's like, those were the scenes that reminded me of The Dentist, because like if Larry, you know, where it's like Corbin Burnson is just kind of a meh actor, but like give him a crazy person to play and he like blows you away. Larry Drake was kind of the same way because he's so great in Darkman, and it would be like, you know, if you're going to have him, you know, it takes more creativity and imagination to make the killer of your horror movie basically the main character. And the movie could have been salvageable that way, but there's no way that, I mean, because they were making it along the lines of a slasher formula, there was no way they were going to do that.
Did you think for one second the father was going to die?
Actually, no.
Yeah, me neither. Okay.
Yeah, the dad is played by Cliff DeYoung, and
yeah, it just seemed like he couldn't die.
As soon as they set him up, I thought he would be the one to rescue his daughter at the end, but he's not.
And so they come close to killing him, but they don't kill him, and he shows up at the end, sort of to go, "Hey, how you doing?" And sort of a scene like at the end of "Kiss Kiss Bang Bang" when the entire cast parades in. But I mean, I thought it was interesting that the character did have a, well, not interesting, but I thought it was funny in sort of a bad movie kind of way, that it's so poorly written. They have this, you know, the main character, her tie to Dr. Giggles is she has a heart problem and his mother had a heart problem. Oh, wow. IMDb still has exclusive Cage and Herzog reteaming for Dr. Giggles remake. But anyway, the stepmother, no, she's evil. It's not like she's misunderstood. It's not like anything. They set her up as being a jerk. It's really funny.
So that she can be killed by Dr. Giggles in the next scene.
I felt really bad for Richard Bradford in this.
Which one was he?
He's the old cop who in his youth witnessed him. Yeah, I felt bad for him. I thought it was interesting that the hero was basically an urban black guy cop.
Yeah, he kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. There's like three black people in town. Two of them are dead. The other one's a new cop. That was interesting.
And that black young black cop kind of gets to be the hero without ever having a character written.
No. Ooh, and apparently he's a musical artist of some kind.
Well, so. you know, it was really funny production design wise when the two seemingly different movies have finally converged and Dr. Giggles is actually going after the girl who's going to be the final survivor. Like, he's broken into his old medical offices to use her to, he's taken her there, and it's like the old medical offices, it's like the crew just went into some like real doctor's office and put fake cobwebs on the walls, and it's like it hasn't supposed to have been used in however many years, but it's,
yeah,
it's so obviously been, it's still being used. They just put Halloween decorate. It's like they went there during Halloween and just filmed it on the day that the Halloween decorations were in the office.
It's also supposed to be in the basement of a house. Like, and yes, I realize it's a somewhat big Victorian, but it's not big enough to have a huge office with multiple examination rooms. And the question of that is, why does one doctor need multiple examination rooms?
Right.
I guess it's not really a question, but it's something else.
They needed to do that so that they could put the bodies of all of Giggles' former victims in the waiting room.
I will say that, you know, this is one of those, you know, Scream really made you like the characters or tried to or whatever. There's not a single likable victim in this. I mean, like, they could have killed the boyfriend and I would have been fine. I was like, that's great. I mean, the girl a little bit, just because she's not as lame as everybody else, but, you know, she's got that wicked stepmother. But, yeah, right. Everybody else, like, this is the cast of people. I liked the people in Freddy's Dead more than
that. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They had more personality.
So, especially the guy with the really bad hair, I couldn't wait for him to die.
The white guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Me too.
But they let the kid live, so the movie doesn't... Manny Coto did not have the...
what the...
gonads to let the kid... to kill a kid.
There's so much almost clever stuff in this movie, and one of the... There's fireworks going off in the background behind me. Sorry, listeners.
There's fireworks going off here, too, so...
It's the 4th of July.
And there were fireworks in the movie, so...
Hey, when he goes into the house of the stupid kid with the bad hair, and he kills him, and he kills his girlfriend, and he comes downstairs, and like the kid's little brother is playing Dr. Mario on his Nintendo, which is a half funny joke. Did you hear what the heck Dr. Giggles says when he like decides not to kill the kid?
Terminal or something.
Okay, I thought it had to be something like that, yeah. An anti-video games will rot your mind joke.
Except Dr. Giggles had been in a sanitarium for... He'd been in a mental institution for 35 years, so he'd have no idea what video games were, other than that.
That's true. And I find it hard to believe he wouldn't kill the kid, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, it's not like Louis Bowl was making it.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, the other thing about that scene is that, well, first of all, it's pretty bad. And now I'm just listing things that are wrong with this movie, which is a little too easy. But first of all, who the heck opens a condom over an open toilet bowl? Remember when he drops his condom in the toilet bowl and has to fish it out?
Yeah,
who does that? Except for a stupid movie character. And then also when he climbs into bed and is crawling under the covers, and suddenly it's not his girlfriend under the covers, it's Giggles. Like, how the heck big was that bed that he could, like, crawl under it for a few feet and not realize that the person under the covers wasn't his girlfriend? It's like he's crawling in the bed from Wes Craven's New Nightmare. It just goes on forever, and it's just a tunnel.
And how could he not have noticed that his girlfriend wasn't as big as Larry Drake from the... Yeah.
So that's just nitpicking. I mentioned the carnival that shows up out of nowhere. It also shows up out of nowhere in Child's Play 3 at the end. But anyways, this carnival shows up out of nowhere, and he chases the main girl around in a hall of mirrors a little. And it's like, wow, I don't quite see how that fits the whole medical doctor gimmick. But that was one of the times that I wished we could have secured a widescreen cut of this movie.
I mean, that's kind of the thing. We haven't really been mocking Manny Coto's directorial abilities. The movie was shot 2/3/5. I believe it was released 2/3/5 on Laserdisc and on the first DVD back in 99, which went out of print. And then Warner Brothers got a hold of it and either released it pan and scan, or maybe the 99 DVD was 16:9, but not... but sort of pan and scan 16:9. It wasn't the full Panavision frame. So according to Wikipedia, those original Laserdiscs go for quite a bit. So, yeah, I wish we could have seen.
The Nightmare on Elm Street, I just learned this yesterday, but the Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child, that was released uncut on Laserdisc only. So that's another... terrible horror movie with a valuable laser disc.
What else is there? Well, I mean, yeah, you could list those for probably 3 minutes, but what else is there to say about Dr. Giggles? I mean, it...
I don't know. It's kind of admirable how they included every single medical post-mortem one-liner that they could have possibly thought of. I mean, they don't skimp on that, at least.
No. It had a successful advertising campaign because it's not the lowest grossing movie of all time. So people did go see it.
I think it's kind of I've always kind of like bared ill will towards the fact that that it was advertised in comic books, because the ad did scare me as a kid, and I was just a kid reading the Spider-Man comic, and then I read this.
What Spider-Man comic? It had guns in it. That was for adults anyway. Mom.
Yeah, but the story was about a kid finding a gun and learning that you can't, you know, guns are bad, basically.
That's kind of funny because I'm not sure if you're aware of the, as we go off on a big tangent here, the new Wonder Woman. Did you see anything about that?
Didn't they just give her pants or something?
They gave her pants and a jean jacket type deal. But the guy who's writing it is J. Michael Straczynski, who actually sent me hate mail once. But anyway, he wrote a Spider-Man story in the early 2000s, post-Columbine, all about that, what you're talking about, a kid bringing a gun to the school. I didn't realize they'd already done it in Spider-Man. And I'll point out that when I mentioned that episode of Beverly Hills 90210 where they did that, you acted like I, you know, was watching too much Beverly Hills 90210, but they obviously do it in Spider-Man too.
Yep.
I will say that at least on the DC side, they advertise in the True Readers line.
Well, I think I just picked up The Amazing Spider-Man, and Dr. Giggles was on the back cover. And that tagline, which was scarier than anything in the movie, except maybe the kid crawling out of his mother's stomach. People should look at that scene on YouTube if it's on there, because it's truly grotesque.
It's really gross. And it's not like he went insane after that. There's no metaphor there for birth. Manny Cotto don't do that. It's just a really gross scene.
Yeah, because we're talking about, like, again, with the state-of-the-art prosthetics, like a completely realistic-looking dummy of a naked dead woman and a kid crawling out of the stomach, slicing his way out from inside. Definitely belonged in a better movie.
Oh, you know what? You know who ought to remake this? Platinum Dunes.
Yes.
And by the time they're ready to remake it, Nicolas Cage's career will be in a place where he'll be in it.
It's funny how if they made Dr. Giggles now, it would be like a torture movie along the lines of Hostel and Saw, but because it was at the time and, you know, it was post Freddy and Jason, but pre-Scream, they just had him, you know, killing people relatively quickly and getting to the one-liners. There's some. It's kind of an old-fashionedness about it that's kind of heartwarming in a way, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I like how the black cop finds a scrap of Larry Drake's medical or insane asylum uniform and can't piece that together. That there might be a killer on the loose, but anyways. Yeah, what else about Dr. Giggles? Dr. Giggles' laugh is really stupid. And I know he's called Dr. Giggles and he has to giggle, but I think it was like the least frightening giggle that any movie serial killer psychopath has ever had. They should have brought in like Andy Robinson to dub in some crazy giggling or something.
Well, imagine if they'd had Andy Robinson play him, but anyway.
They could have done that. I mean, I don't think Andy Robinson was that much older than Larry Drake at the time. A little bit, but not too much. What else? There's a really bad CG opening where we're like traveling through someone's bloodstream.
Did that remind you of Innerspace?
It reminded me of a lot of movies. But no, not Innerspace in particular.
I did find the gravitas they put to Dr. Giggles appearing on screen very interesting. Like, remember when the title came up, it was like, it took a while, and the music was coming up, and it was like, I just can't wait to see it say Dr. Giggles, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, Manny Coto does sort of, you know, have Larry Drake appear on screen like a, you know, a powerful and intimidating figure and a force of nature and stuff. Go give him credit for that. He doesn't, he treats Giggles with some gravity. Dr. Giggles. Dr. Giggles.
I think we're done.
Well, all right. I'll have to do this again sometime. Shall we talk about our next episode then?
Yes, now, since it is actually, which I didn't even notice until last week or something, next episode will be our 50th episode.
Yeah, and that's cool. And in honor of the occasion, both of our good movie and bad movie are going to be Alan Smithy movies. We haven't seen either of them. The good movie was the very first movie to have an Alan Smithy credit, created, but which Don Siegel created, mentioned earlier in this episode, coincidentally. And the movie is Death of a Gunfighter, right?
Yeah, Death of a Gunfighter, starring Richard Widmark, who apparently was
awesome.
A bastard on set that neither Siegel or the other director wanted their name on it.
Wow. Well, love Richard Widmark.
So
actually.
Do I. And this is a very well-reviewed movie. I mean, New York Times commented on how good Alan Smithy was of a director. And I guess even Roger Ebert really liked it. Though, yes, Roger Ebert was reviewing stuff in 1969. Anyway, and then our bad movie.
Our bad movie is... another horror film by the director of Halloween 2, which we did a commentary on once. And that director is, what the heck is his
name? Rick Rosenthal.
Rick Rosenthal. And he directed another sequel to a great horror movie called The Birds. His was The Birds 2, Land's End. And it came out in the early 90s, like 91 or 92, and it was... It was made for TV, probably like Showtime or something.
Yeah.
But anyways, I'm kind of curious. I always like a good bad horror movie, so...
Very interestingly, I'm sure I'll talk about it next week, but it's possible I won't. Bruce Surtees, who shot Dirty Harry, Lenny, The Shootist, Firefox, a bunch of... he was Clint Eastwood's director of photography until the late... 80s. He shot Birds too, so who knows? But he also shot Bad Boys, directed by Rick Rosenthal, so that must have been where they met.
Cool.
So
all right, so yeah, that's gonna be great. It's gonna be a very special Alan Smithy podcast, and we hope you'll tune in. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt,
and this has been Andrew,
and thanks for listening. Check out our site, alansmithypodcast.info, for previous episodes, and we'll see you next time.